You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
So for all the young people in this room and those who are watching... Know that this country belongs to you from every background and walk of life. With a lot of hard work and a good education, anything is possible, even becoming president. That's what the American dream is all about.
Michelle Obama there in her final remarks as America's first lady will consider her legacy in the White House. Plus, Donald Trump versus the intelligence community. We'll have the latest in what's proving a pretty dramatic battle. Also ahead, the space travel industry is taking off. See what we've done there. But is increasing privatization a good or bad thing? We'll be having that debate. And as Norway gets rid of FM radio in the country, my guests will recall their fondest moments gathered around the wireless. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House, wherever you are in the world. It's Friday, as ever. It's an in-house affair. My guests today are Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, and Monocle 24 stalwart, Henry Rees Sheridan. Very good afternoon to you both. Welcome to the programme. Let's start with that speech. We just heard an extract. America's First Lady, the country's first African-American First Lady, indeed, spoke today in her final official speech in the role. Steve, Michelle Obama, understandably, I guess, was talking about education. She was talking quite directly to, you know, the young people of America and saying the American dream lives on. That's understandable. What do you think? I mean, I don't know. What's the legacy of Michelle Obama specifically when we look at the soon to be departed Obama family?
I think we need to remember how Michelle Obama was first presented when Barack Obama ran in 2008. And in many ways, the attacks on her were worse than the attacks on her husband, because she was that terrible thing, a strong woman, worse than that, a strong black woman. And there were some people who thought, well, this might be a bit of a problem. You know, there's one thing to say, is America ready for a mixed race president? But is America really ready for a black first lady? Well, we don't know. And so if you look at her first speech in 2008 at the convention, it was very much about introducing her as a wife and a mother. It was very little really about her own professional life, her own experiences, her own intelligence. But over the past 8 years, she's had the opportunity to basically cast that to one side and be able to present herself as she is to the American people. And she's been an incredibly popular first lady. Not only has she been, you know, does her popularity extend to most Americans, but she has been an inspirational first lady for black women in America. And you know, it's interesting, we're doing an edition of the Foreign Desk this week on Barack Obama's legacy, and one of the people I was speaking to, a guy called Van Newkirk, who's a great writer at The Atlantic, was saying, look, I was 20 when Obama became president, and this was the first time in my life that, you know, I knew that, okay, fine, that a black guy could become president, and this has been a huge thing for me personally as well. So I think, you know, the influence that she's had, the inspiration that she's given. I mean, we can get on to sort of, you know, her political role over the last year and so in a moment. But I think it, just in terms of that role that she's played over the past 8 years has been phenomenal and history making.
And Henry, it's interesting, isn't it? She certainly dealt with a lot of the worst that was thrown at her with a deal of sort of grace, very dignified, and with some good humour. But it's quite interesting. Steve mentioned that this. It's quite a journey that she's been on in terms of how she presented herself to certainly her sort of activities, more political pronouncements in the last 18 months or so. With Donald Trump, and it's hard not to look at this contrast, which seems ever more stark, we get the prefabbed Trump reality TV family. And it's strange, as much of a stark contrast as Donald Trump will provide to Barack Obama, one imagines the same will be true with Melania Trump and Michelle Obama.
I mean, I don't want to speculate too much about Melania Trump now. I don't know much about her, and obviously we haven't seen how she's going
Never
to perform.
Never let that stand in the way, Henry.
In office. But, you know, I think in a recent chat, I think it was with David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, there was a remark that Obama made that he was certain that the biggest draw to the new presidential center that he wants to erect in Chicago is going to be Michelle's dresses. And that really struck me as being telling of Michelle's position on the national stage. First of all, her popularity, but second of all, how difficult it is for someone in her position, not only the First Lady, but, you know, a black First Lady, the wife of the first black president, to attain popularity and fulfill that role. Coming back to the dresses, she doesn't only have to be extraordinarily intellectually serious-minded and is expected to be so as the wife of the President of the United States, but she's also held under the same microscope as A-list celebrities with regards to her personal habits, you know, the people she surrounds herself with, of course, her dress style. It is a phenomenally difficult role to adapt to, particularly if you're being held up to various double standards.
Yeah, that really annoyed me, actually. I mean, obviously, you know, what he chooses to say about his wife is entirely up to him, and I don't want to put words into his mouth, but it's surely we can move beyond her dresses and her style. Yes, there is an issue here about, you know, the fact that
isn't he just calling shots and saying, look, he's not saying he is advocating that, he's just saying the fact remains,
know,
that will be a draw.
It's just I think it sort of belittles what she's done, particularly over the past year, where she was, without doubt, the greatest advocate for Hillary Clinton, greater even than Hillary Clinton herself. The speech she made at the convention was superb, the best of the lot. And then, during the campaign, she made the best speech, when she was the only person who actually took on Donald Trump for his misogyny, straight on, with a whole speech about it. Hillary Clinton didn't do that. Mm. She didn't have the guts to do that, whereas Michelle Obama made that really astonishing speech, I think it was in Manchester, New Hampshire, where you could see, you know, how this had affected her, how not just offended, but how shocked she was that someone would talk about women in this way. Talking about,
and she was angry, but it was
sexually assaulted,
and it was controlled anger, which is perhaps what
it was.
The campaign lacked.
It was a brilliantly angry, as you say, controlled angry speech, and I think it was, as I say, she became, you know, the greatest advocate for a so-so candidate.
I do have to disagree with Slee slightly here, because I think that Obama's comment, actually, one of the most remarkable things about them as a couple is, I think, how palpable their mutual respect for each other is. Obama clearly,
I'm not saying he doesn't love his wife or have respect for his wife.
But where I was going with that is that I think that Obama, with that comment, was slightly taking the piss out of the forces in American society, you know, that come from all corners of it, that, you know, hold his wife under this microscope, when he knows that she is so much more.
Well, let's not forget, he's talking to an electorate that did end up voting for said aforementioned a misogynist. Steve, just to go back, though, we alluded to it twice, just to be slightly more explicit about this shift in the dynamic. Obviously, you know, Michelle, you know, she got her feet under the table. She was, I guess, she could afford to go out on a limb more later in the second term. Frequently, that's how the administrations go. What did you make of her performance? And it's funny, going on what you've just said about how strong her oratory was and what a compelling character she is. It's a bit of a flippant remark, but one wonders about Michelle Obama in the White House. But
it's such a tired idea.
But what about that? Her political pronouncements. Do you think that was well judged, and that move on her part? It sat rather comfortably.
I think it did, yes. I think it did. And I think also because she doesn't appear to have political aspirations. She, you know, she has made it pretty clear she doesn't want to run for election. I'm sure she will come out and make speeches at election times for others. But here's the other thing. It's a really weird role. First Lady. It's a stupid role. It's, you know, because it is, you know, as Henry's saying, it is ceremonial. It is like, you're the person that stands next to the president. You're just there because you're his wife. And, you know, you saw Hillary Clinton try to transform that role in the 1990s and got huge amounts of abuse for it.
And possibly built some of the unpopularity, which...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, how dare she, involve herself in these things? Michelle Obama perhaps found the right balance, if you like, in terms of how she tries to do the ceremony, but also have a political voice, whether that was to do with, healthy eating or, during, his time in office, but then campaigning quite forcefully at the end.
I also just want to take this opportunity to point out that obviously there are many tragic elements to Hillary Clinton's failure to be elected president of the United States of America. But one of the biggest ones for me is the missed opportunity of being able to see Bill Clinton as the first gentleman of the United States of America, because I think that would have been an extremely entertaining performance indeed, and one which we may not now be able to avail ourselves of.
And I doubt that had that happened and Hillary Clinton had her presidential library, there would be Bill Clinton suits on display.
Possibly. I imagine you're probably right, Steve. Let's turn to President-elect Trump. We've mentioned him already. Today he was expected to be briefed by members of the US intelligence community on Russia's influence in November's election. Trump remains adamant that Russian involvement was minimal, despite reports suggesting the US has now identified specific Russian agents who are alleged to have sent stolen Democratic Party emails to WikiLeaks, amongst other things. Henry, this is a kind of an ongoing discussion, and it seems to mainly focus on this notion that Donald Trump has a degree of contempt for the traditional intelligence agencies. He made very clear early on that the briefings were of little interest or even of import to him. And this seems to be rumbling on. I guess first up, we shouldn't be surprised.
No, I don't think we should be. One thing that's interesting about this whole thing to me is to compare it to what we've seen happen in the UK with Sir Ivan Rogers, the permanent representative for the UK in Brussels, retiring this week, announcing his resignation, blaming muddle-headed thinking on the part of the government as one of the reasons for that, or at least warning his colleagues of that as a factor that they're going to have to deal with this new administration. With both the Brexit vote and also the election of Trump, a lot was made with regards to the, dismissal of facts, expertise, evidence on the part of the electorate for the issues at hand. But now that their issues have taken hold, their issues have won out and their candidates have been elected, it's interesting to see these specific candidates and these specific governments coming head to head with the actual people who are the experts, the civil servants in America and in Britain. And you might hope that expertise might prevail in that less abstract context, that the people who actually embody the expertise, the expert, will act as a bulwark against our worst tendencies. But apparently, the elected officials, the relevant elected officials, are actually carrying through this contempt for expertise on both sides of the pond.
Steve, I don't want to get bogged down in the detail of what Trump thinks or the people's whose version of events he rates as being, more, reliable than CIA or FBI briefings or National Security Agency even. But what do you think is it unrealistic to expect that post January the 20th we could see a shift from him? It was pointed out to me earlier that he was still tweeting about, TV ratings for his show being stewarded by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and you fear, what is going to happen with a man who is so happy to make his obvious priorities public. Presumably something will shift, won't it, after the 20th?
I would not make any assumptions. I think we're in slightly uncharted waters here. Look, there is nothing wrong with a president, or at this stage president-elect, being sceptical of what his intelligence services bring to him. In fact, actually, he should be sceptical. It's right to look at these things sceptically. But there is something very bizarre about airing your scepticism of your own nation's intelligence services
prior to even sitting down
to the rest of the world before you have even sat, well, at any stage, but particularly before you've sat down with them, and at the same time publicly siding with the president of a nation, Russia, which your intelligence services seem to think have been attacking you. It's
and they're willing to cite specific individuals behind closed doors.
Yes, indeed. So that is odd, to say the least. And, you know, you look at other Republicans, and none are rushing to his defence to say, oh, no, no, Mr. Trump is quite right to be sceptical here. Now, I think that, given what's going on, the Democratic Party could help somewhat by saying, look, this is separate from what impact or other this had on the election. That's, you know, did these emails, that the hacking of these emails at John Podesta and the DNC, did that lead to Hillary Clinton losing? No, it led to a damaging drip-drip news effect over the weeks leading up to that. But there were bigger things that played a part, not least James Comey, the director of the FBI, who's must be loving all this at the moment, because it means that his head is no longer on the block as it perhaps should have been. This is an issue for America of national security if key parts of the democratic infrastructure are being targeted by another nation and are being hacked by another nation. And that should, in a sense, be separated from the impact that it had. And, you know, some congressmen and senators are trying to do that, but Mr. Trump is trying to conflate the two and say, oh, this is all about, you know, they're poor losers and they're grabbing hold of anything they can.
I just want to move on and ask briefly another Trump-related story, which is doing the rounds, which is this reported demand that his ambassadors, or those appointed by his predecessor, Barack Obama, have to leave their posts before Inauguration Day, which, as mentioned, is on the 20th, and that's not very much time. The deadline, almost only days away, ambassadors have expressed their concern. The move seems to suggest that America will or could leave no envoys in countries like Germany, like Canada, like the UK even, Henry. Again, this rather fits with the prevailing view of how one expected Trump to behave: disruptive, no respecter of convention or tradition. But it's, again, it sends a quite bizarre message to, in some cases, America's strongest allies.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think that there is valid difference in the emotional reaction between expecting someone to do something crazy and then seeing them actually begin to do it. My favourite detail of this story is that Trump's ex-wife, Ivana Trump, the mother of some of his children, has already put herself forward to become the ambassador of the Czech Republic, which has been welcomed by Miloš Zeman, the president of the Czech Republic. He said they could not send a better US ambassador to Prague. So watch this space.
Steve?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, there's a weird thing about the way that America chooses its ambassadors. This is under all presidents. That they, you know, yes, they have some career diplomats, but they also have some people who are chosen by the president. And sometimes they are interesting people who do a very good job. Matthew Barzan, who's been Obama's man here in London, has, I think most people in the diplomatic community here in London would say, has been a very good ambassador, a really interesting guy, very engaged. There was a former bundler for George W. Bush, as they're known, someone who raised a lot of money, bundled money together from Texas, who made less of a splash when he was here. And I think there is going to be this issue as well in the coming months about, you know, these key allies, Britain, Canada, I think, Germany, where they may not have an ambassador for a while. Because that's the other thing we shouldn't forget. It takes a really long time to appoint an ambassador in the US because they need to be approved. There's a Senate committee that needs to approve them. And actually, at the moment, there's still, until recently, I think there was a whole bunch of places which didn't have ambassadors because one guy in the Senate was like, I've got a block on this. So, you know, at quite key moments, you might have no figureheads, no representatives for you at different places.
And Steve, at that connection, I think one thing that's also interesting about this is that, you know, whether it's Sir Ivan Rogers quitting his position in the UK, blaming the UK government's disorganisation, or the Trump administration, well, administration in waiting, we should remind ourselves, coming out with these fairly rash moves already. for me, I don't get from this a sense of kind of an omniscient menace. I get a sense of incompetence and naivety, which perhaps is more alarming.
Well, we like to strike a reassuring note on Midori House. Let's look to the skies next. For a slight change of pace. Beyond the skies, maybe. We're talking space travel. SpaceX, the private commercial space exploration concern founded by Elon Musk, is primed to resume its rocket launches next week, perhaps as early as Monday, after a series of delays linked to the failed launch and destruction of one of its Falcon 9 rockets and its $200 million satellite payload back in September. Henry Rees Sheridan, Elon Musk said, all systems are go for launch next week.
Should we
welcome that news unequivocally, or should we be more reserved?
Unequivocally welcome. That's my opinion, okay. My nuanced opinion. I love SpaceX and private space companies like them because I think that they are stepping in to fill the void that's been left by the rolling back of public space missions, particularly NASA, in recent decades. And I'm very happy for private money to be being spent on rockets exploding on the launch pad rather than public money. And I think it's very easy. I do think that, you know, with people like Elon Musk at the head of these companies, to a certain extent, they have been grouped together in the public mind, along with kind of various other kind of nefarious Silicon Valley vegan cyborgs, right, who like are kind of disdaining the rest of us. But, you know, we've got to bear in mind, this could potentially yield massive, massive benefit for all of us here on planet Earth. You know, I mean, they're delivering just this next planned launch is meant to deliver air control satellites, which are of obvious benefit. And, you know, yes, tomorrow it might be space tourism for the 1%. But then after that, we could be looking at extracting mineral resources from space, all sorts of things that could be to the betterment of humanity. And, you know, most of the research for this, most of the pioneering steps will have been taken by these private companies. Why wouldn't we want that? They'll be pooling all the risk themselves.
Steve, is Henry right? Should we be looking at this simply as a debit credit ledger thing and saying, look, if they're taking on the risk, they're pouring in the private money, sure, they're going to build in some profitability down the line, otherwise they wouldn't be doing these things. But their rationale is, look, if this comes off, everyone gains. Mm. Does that hold water?
Yes. I mean, look, I, in an ideal world, NASA would still be well funded. It would still be sending out missions. It would, you know, the European Space Agency would also be better funded than it is at the moment. But given that isn't happening, I think it's good that there are private companies that are stepping into the breach. And, you know, I know Richard Branson and Virgin like to talk about his plans, but since his plans never seem to get anywhere, I don't think he's really worth giving him the oxygen of publicity. What's interesting about Elon Musk and SpaceX is they really are doing things and they're trying. And also, and this is what I rather like about it, they're quite happy or quite, they're prepared to fail in public. Mm. So they're saying, look, we're going to have this launch next week and you can live stream it, you can all watch it. And it might not work, as some of the other previous ones haven't. Some have like exploded straight away. Well, they've gone up and come back down and crashed. And they've been like, okay, well...
Well, they're comfortable with failure. I mean,
let's start again.
Musk is a Silicon Valley veteran. And they say, you know, Silicon Valley is built on failure. That people are used to their concerns not working. So he doesn't have the same... There's no negative association with him about things not coming off.
No, indeed. And that's how you get somewhere in the end. And I think what's interesting about Musk is as well that when you look at what he's done with Tesla, with the car, with the new batteries that he's trying to build, which, you know, batteries do not sound exciting. However, you know, the batteries that he is trying to build at the moment could be, you know, really life-changing, you know, because one of the big issues is about how you store energy, not just how you use it. The way the recent thing he's done with solar roof tiles, you know, so forget those sort of slightly weird, ugly-looking solar panels that people are putting up. You know, you'll have actual roof tiles that suck in solar energy.
Could be game changers, Steve.
Game changers, Tom. Game changers.
Let's move on. Henry, enough from you for now. We were travelling through space. Let's stay broadly in the aviation arena. JFK Airport in New York. It's not popular, but it could undergo a massive overhaul if Andrew Cuomo's plans go ahead. He's unveiled a $10 billion plan to renovate the airport. It's notoriously, I'll be polite and say, less than efficient. It's infamously maybe worse than that. But what makes an airport great or good? we're slightly short of time, but Henry, in a word or two, I mean, is it about easy wayfinding? Is it about functionality? What is it in your view that sort of makes an airport work?
Genuinely, wayfinding does jump out to me because I'm an easily disoriented man. And I do need clear typography at eye level in order to find my way around. So I hope that we're going to be getting in some good graphic designers for this new refurb. Other than that, all the obvious stuff. You want a nice selection of restaurants, don't you? I think it's nice to have some kind of reflection of the local. Now, I know that airports are usually in weird kind of non-places.
No, but I know what you're saying.
You know, the local culture in there. Yeah, hopefully it will go to plan.
Steve, why? You're one of the long list here at Monocle that are, how should I say, really not fans of JFK. Why so much animosity?
Well, look, I mean, Henry says it should reflect the local culture. And do I say this? Yes, in a way it does. You know, it's cramped. It's poorly built. Everyone there's rude. The food is terrible. The security
are you heading there anytime soon?
The security is kind of threatening of anyone who's not American. And even actually, if you are American, they're a bit like, who are you and what are you doing here? It is a terrible, terrible airport. And even worse than the airport itself is the way out of the airport. Mm. And this is what I think is actually quite interesting. I'd be interested to see what Governor Cuomo is going to do about this, because as part of this plan, they are looking at what they do to try and ease the journey from JFK into New York proper. Because, you know, look, the Heathrow Express here in the UK is possibly the most expensive railway to go on in the world. I mean, it's extortionate, but it gets you into town quickly, and there is that option. In New York, it's, you know, it's not good.
It's a battle at the best of times. We're ticking towards the end of the show, but we've got a few minutes left.
Can I just say, there are lots of other really nice airports in America. It's just that one. That one's terrible.
Don't try and dig your way out of it now, Steve. Okay. Too late. We're big fans of radio here at Monocle 24. We broadcast via the internet, all the better to reach our global listeners and not over the more traditional airwaves. It seems Norway's following our lead. The country is going to switch off its FM radio network next week. And this, interestingly, despite 66% of Norwegians opposing that move. Henry, you're a relative youngster. Do you have any pleasing early memories? Curled up by the fire, the wireless on, the Rhys Sheridans all tuned into a particular broadcast?
Yeah, I mean, I did listen. I used to stay up late to listen to my favourite esoteric music programmes on Radio 1 and actually sometimes tape them. So I have fond memories of analogue radio.
They didn't have tapes when you were a boy, did they?
But I think that one of the I think one of the interesting points that has been raised in relation to this is that, you know, in Norway alone, they think that there's 2 million vehicles which are not equipped with DAB radio. And I think that one of the interesting upshots of the debate that surrounds a decision like this is just the insight into the way people consume various mediums. You know, like, in-car consumption is a huge, huge point of consumption for radio. It's not necessarily one that you would think about, you know, when you're just sitting at home thinking about where people listen to radio. But, you know, they recommend that people have to buy adapters, which is, you know,
well,
a bit naff, isn't it?
Steve, in a minute or under, is Henry right? Do we sometimes move too fast and people welcome this and say, oh, great, you know, digital is very democratising and it brings people together. But some people, you know, what if you've got an old car? You're left behind.
Well, indeed. I mean, I still have a black and white TV. So, no, look, it's you have to be careful with these things. And for example, in the UK, they've talked about eventually at one stage, possibly, maybe, I don't know, having an FM switch off. But it's a decade away, at least, before they even think about it. It's, yes, you know, digital offers more options, but, you know, for many people, FM is fine, and, you know, there's no problem with it. The internet is obviously the future, Tom, but
newer and shinier isn't always better, though.
No.
We'll end on that note, on a reassuringly Luddite note. Thanks, gentlemen. That's Steve Bloomfield and Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan, my guest today on Midori House. The programme was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next. 1900, it's The Menu with Marco Sippi. And more on the day's main story, some of which we've delved into already on Midori House. Coming away on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. Do join us then. From me, Tom Edwards, and the crew, thanks for tuning in.